this ideology going after children, sterilizing and mutilating them, is wrong, and it has to stop.
Can states ban gender transition procedures for young people? I'm Marcel Rages, standing in front of the Supreme Court, where oral arguments are taking place. We'll have more for you coming up next.
The United States Supreme Court takes on the controversial issue of gender transitioning for minors. Coverage of the historic case from a Catholic perspective.
There are a lot of cardinals here from what we might say peripheral nations within the Catholic communion.
A new group is elevated this weekend to the College of Cardinals. Our senior Vatican analyst joins us to discuss the significance of Pope Francis's selections. The life of a Catholic farm family, devotion to the Lord, and respect for the land. We head to Nebraska to talk about their farming tradition. And will Meatless Fridays make a comeback? EWTN News in Depth starts right now.
It's child abuse. This is child mutilation. Like, stopping children's puberty is insanity. I never in my life thought that something like this would ever even be possible in a civilized society in the year 2024.
Dozens of protesters, from medical professionals to concerned parents, stood on the steps of the Supreme Court this week as the court tackles the topic of transgenderism. The case could impact laws in more than half the states in the nation. Welcome to EWTN News in Depth. I'm Catherine Hadro. The current Supreme Court is no stranger to hot-button issues, from abortion to affirmative action to gun laws. On Wednesday of this week, it took on another controversy in a historic first: gender transition treatments for minors. Reporter Roselle Rages was outside the high court.
Protect trans kids! Protect trans kids!
On a chilly December morning, dozens of protesters stood outside the U.S. Supreme Court in our nation's capital as it took on a controversial issue for the first time in its history: gender transition procedures for minors. This blockbuster case, called the United States versus Scrimeti, concerns Tennessee's law that limits medical procedures and interventions for youth who struggle with gender discordance. Three teens who identify as transgender and a medical doctor, represented by the Justice Department and the American Civil Liberties Union, brought the case against the state. They allege the law violates the Equal Protection Clause by making distinctions based on sex. Tennessee Attorney General Jonathan Scrimeti told EWTN News Nightly that the law protects children from gender ideology.
I think if you look at the record of the legislative proceedings that led to this law, in which the Tennessee General Assembly very carefully considered evidence, heard testimony, looked at developments elsewhere, everything about it is focused on kids and protecting kids' safety.
Within just a few years, concerns over the impact of gender transition procedures on youth went from a fringe idea to a top priority for Republican legislators. Including Tennessee, 26 states currently have restrictions on the treatments in the books, including puberty blockers, hormone therapy, and surgical procedures. The court's decision, which is expected next summer, could drastically impact these laws. Inside the court, a tense oral argument lasted more than 2 hours. A lawyer from ACLU who identifies as transgender, the first to ever argue in the high court, spoke on behalf of the teens.
If you're someone who was born male and you are going through puberty too early, you want to be able to have a final adult height that is typical of boys. You may receive puberty blockers so that you can develop as a typical boy. Someone who has a sex of female at birth is also receiving puberty blockers so that they can undergo a puberty like other boys. And so it is the same purpose. And what makes the treatment prohibited for the birth sex female is their sex.
When sparring with the liberal justices, Tennessee Solicitor General Matthew Rice reiterated that the law looks not at the patient's sex, but at medical purposes.
I took the SG to be saying that it operates on the body in the same way. So what's your basis for saying they're not the same?
I don't think it operates on the body in the same way. Take testosterone. If you give a boy with a deficiency testosterone because he has constitutional delayed puberty, that allows him to go through and develop the reproductive organs associated with being a male. If you give it to a girl, it renders the girl infertile.
The conservative majority of the court seemed skeptical of the Biden administration's claim and expressed the issue might be best left up to the states.
And, you know, we might think that we can do just as good a job with respect to the evidence here as Tennessee or anybody else. But my understanding is that the Constitution leaves that question to the people's representatives rather than to nine people, none of whom is a doctor.
Stop the harm! Stop the harm!
Outside the court, the debate was just as heated.
I'm in front of the Supreme Court, and as you can see behind me, on one side you have a rally to stop the harm against America's kids, and on the other side, a rally to keep gender transition procedures.
And for many there, the issue is personal.
Because I grew up in the 60s and 70s with gender dysphoria, and grew up with a lot of shame. I remember being that 8-year-old that felt suicidal. How am I going to be for that kid that's here today?
I'm here because at one point my daughter said that she was a boy, and every medical provider that I sought help from told me that I needed to transition her. I promised that I would fight for all the other children that are getting swept up in gender ideology. So I'm here today to support those who are fighting against this.
Detransitioner Precia Mosley spoke in front of the crowd and told her story. At only 16 years old, she was given medication to stop her menstrual cycle. And by 18, she had her first surgery.
I'm here because I'm lucky or blessed. I was able to reconcile with my natal sex and be okay with that and heal from trauma and pain.
She hopes the Supreme Court will rule in favor of Tennessee's law and protect other kids like her.
I testified for this bill originally in Tennessee. I think this is a great bill. This bill not only protects children who are minors from getting, from consenting to procedures they have no ability to actually consent to, it also helps them hold doctors accountable. This isn't an issue of hate.
I didn't have a chance.
It's love. I wish someone would have stood up and protected me. I wish these laws had been here.
Rosal Regis, EWTN News in Depth.
For analysis on this historic case, we turn to two experts on the issue. Josh Payne is an attorney and founding partner at Campbell Miller Payne, the first law firm dedicated to representing detransitioners who feel misled by the promises of gender transition procedures. And Dr. Teresa Farnan is a Catholic moral philosopher and fellow at the Ethics and Public Policy Center. She's a founding member of the center's Person and Identity Project, a special initiative to promote the Catholic vision of the human person and to respond to the challenges of gender ideology. Thank you both very much for joining us this week. Josh, I want to go to you first. Can you first tell us, what do you hear from your clients about their experiences with these procedures?
Catherine, thank you for having me tonight. Our clients tell cautionary tales, really, about going and seeking medical treatment for great distress that they were experiencing, oftentimes with a host of mental health issues, including depression and anxiety. Some of our clients were also experiencing being on the autism spectrum. Mm-hmm. And instead of receiving proper medical care that led them to a path of healing and understanding of their body and understanding of their sex, they were misled into believing that they could change into something else, something that they were not naturally born as, and that misleading information that they were giving was harmful to them because they lost their healthy, natural bodies through the process of receiving either hormones or surgery, surgical removal of their body parts, or both in some cases.
Mm. Teresa, this is obviously a very charged and emotional topic. Can you explain the Catholic Church's lens on people who identify as transgender and on gender transition procedures?
Sure. And thank you for having us on here for this discussion. This is so important. The first thing to just keep in mind is that what we have going on here are two rival ways of looking at the person. So one way views the person as a unity of body and soul. That's the Catholic Christian anthropology understanding of the person. Mm-hmm. And that sexual difference matters, and it's the foundation of the family. And the goal for someone to flourish is to help them to learn to accept their body as a gift from God, right? And so the second view, which is the view that's proposed by these transgender activists and gender ideologues, is that who you are as a person is the sum total of your desires and your ideas about yourself and your feelings. And so they believe that the body has no intrinsic meaning. And in order to make somebody achieve some kind of happiness or euphoria, you need to surgically alter the body, regardless of the effect on the individual and regardless of the effect on the wider family, causing them to reject their sexual difference so that they can live as they choose without regard to human nature. So the church understands. Pope Francis has been on fire on this issue since 2014, and Pope Benedict before him. And the church understands these are suffering people who are being handed lies about the human person, and these lies about the person lead them to tremendous harm, right? And so the church's lens on persons who identify as transgender really is one of compassion, right? We understand that these are people who are suffering. We see their pain. We understand that. But we also know that what is being promised to them can never deliver, and that the treatments that they are being encouraged to pursue are ultimately going to prove to be grievously harmful, and that the only way to flourish is to accept the gifts, the gift of yourself, the gift of human nature that God has given you.
Josh, looking at this specific court case, can you clarify the specific exact question the Supreme Court justices need to answer? And what struck you from this week's oral arguments?
Yeah, from me or Josh? Go ahead, Josh.
The case is about a law that the Tennessee legislature passed, I believe a year or two ago, to protect minors from these harmful procedures, because we know if someone is not does not have their brain fully developed, if they cannot appreciate dangers and harms and risks, such as taking in substances like tobacco or alcohol, if they're not old enough to vote or be drafted into the military, they're not old enough to appreciate the long-term consequences of potentially losing things like their fertility or their ability to enjoy a sexual life, which many of these cross-sex hormone treatments and surgeries result in. And the question before the Supreme Court is, was the Tennessee legislature entitled to form the judgment they did that this kind of protection of children is necessary and important? And legally, the Supreme Court is looking at the issue from the vantage point of the Equal Protection Clause of the 14th Amendment in the U.S. Constitution, and whether the legislature improperly discriminated here. And Tennessee is arguing in support of their law that it was not improper discrimination, but that it was a reasonable regulation, in fact, to protect children based on their age, and that what Tennessee was concerned with here was not discriminating on the basis of anybody's sex, but protecting both sexes equally from harmful procedures.
Teresa, the mainstream media often portrays anyone who does not support these procedures for minors as cruel, even dangerous. What's your response to that notion? And can you succinctly give some advice for Catholics about balancing that compassion with truth on this topic?
Sure. Well, we have long understood that it definitely is not compassionate to allow someone to harm themselves, right? And so if you understand that by pursuing these treatments, these young people are engaging in medicalized self-harm, there's no way that Catholics can cooperate in that, because that ultimately leads to, you know, harm for the person, harm for the family, ripple effects for everyone. And so I really think it's important for Catholics to understand they've got two missions here. They need to be able to proclaim the truth about the person. These young people who are hurting so badly need to hear the beautiful teachings of the church about the integrity of the body, about the meaning of the body, about how God has a plan for each of us and it's unique. And then they need us to be saying to them, we care about you, we love you, and we love you too much to allow you to do something that is so destructive. Slow down, take your time, you are fine as you are, because God made you and he has a beautiful plan for you.
Josh, as our legal expert here, I want to get your reaction to an exchange during this week's oral arguments between Justice Alito and with the attorney with the ACLU. Take a listen.
Are there individuals who are born male, assigned male at birth, who at one point identify as female, but then later come to identify as male, and likewise for individuals who are assigned female at birth, at some point identify as male, but later come to identify as female? Are there not such people?
There are such people. I agree with that, Justice.
So it's not an immutable characteristic, is it?
Josh, what do you think is the point that Justice Alito is trying to make here, and why is that significant?
Well, under the Equal Protection Clause analysis that the court has set out, the preliminary question is whether the person challenging the law is a member of a protected class of individuals. Classically, we think of any protected class involving people based on their race or based on their sex. And what the challengers were promoting was this idea of, can we add a protected classification of transgender persons as a new classification under the Equal Protection Clause? And Justice Alito in his questioning was suggesting that would not be appropriate, because unlike a person's race or a person's sex, which is immutable, it cannot be changed, a person's transgender status can be changed, because some people, like the clients that my firm, Campbell Miller Payne, represents, at one point in their life felt that they were a gender different from their sex, but then later they detransitioned and returned to identifying with their true natural sex. And that was Justice Alito's point. If somebody's transgender status can change, it would not be appropriate to create a new category under the Equal Protection Clause of a protected class, saying that transgender persons deserve that status, just like someone, you know, who deserves not being discriminated on because of their race or their sex. He said transgender status is different because it does change. It's not immutable. People do detransition, and you heard the challenger's attorney there acknowledge and concede our clients are real. They do exist, and people do change their mind. And that's why Tennessee wants to protect, and many other states, by the way, not just Tennessee. It's I'm not sure it's quite a majority, but it's over 20 states have these laws protecting minors, because we know children and young people may grow up and change their mind, and many do. And many, the overwhelming majority, based on the research that's available, in fact, grow to reconcile with their sex in due time.
Well, we are especially appreciative of both of the perspectives you bring to this story this week. Thank you both. We'll have to leave it there.
Thank you, Catherine.
This is not the only high-profile case at the court this term. Still on the docket is a case about a Texas law requiring age verification for pornographic websites. And at the beginning of this term, the justices heard a case on a regulation cracking down on ghost guns. The Supreme Court is expected to release its rulings on these cases next summer. Stay right there. There's much more ahead on this edition of EWTN News In Depth.
Pope Francis has indeed appointed a large number of the current members of the College of Cardinals, and that's normal. He's been a pope for over 10 years.
An important part of the Pope's legacy is front and center as the College of Cardinals expands this weekend with new members. A look at some of the standout selections with our Vatican expert.
Being thanked for the abundant harvest, you know, and to help me to be share that abundance with people in need.
And later, faith and farming. We visit a Nebraska farm family to find out how their strong Catholic beliefs have sustained them through both lean times and bountiful harvest. EWTN News in Depth is coming right back. This was the scene on Friday morning at the Vatican in anticipation of this weekend's papal consistory. Clerics representing Catholic communities around the world answering reporter inquiries as they discussed the honor they felt at their elevations to the College of Cardinals. 21 men chosen by Pope Francis are receiving the red hat on Saturday at St. Peter's Basilica, including the Archbishops of Tehran, Tokyo, and Toronto. With this new crop of cardinals, we take a look now at some of the notable names and faces joining the college. The Catholic Church's creation of cardinals has captured the world's attention for centuries.
A large audience watches Pope Paul VI holding the fourth public consistory for the consecration of 30 new cardinals.
Receiving the red hat means these men are now considered princes of the Church, second only to the Pope in church hierarchy. They are responsible for electing the next pope, and more likely than not, it's one of them whom will be named the next pope. With such great responsibility, each appointment is closely watched, including this latest slate of 21 cardinals elect.
Well, there's one that stands out to me in particular, and I haven't seen much about him, and that is the Archbishop of Toronto. Frank Leo is like a rising star.
That rising star, 53-year-old Cardinal-elect Francis Leo, is the only delegate from North America this consistory. He recently spoke with EWTN News about the need to defend against the evil of euthanasia.
We must keep firm in our faith, proclaiming the gospel of life and a civilization of love.
Dr. Kurt Martens, canon law professor at the Catholic University of America, explains that canon law requires any cardinal designate to at least be ordained a priest. If he is not yet a bishop, he'll need to either be ordained a bishop before becoming a cardinal or receive a dispensation from that requirement. There are three cardinal-elect priests in this crop who fall under that category. Father Timothy Radcliffe is a 79-year-old English Dominican priest who's caused controversy, including for past comments on same-sex relationships, saying they can be expressive of Christ's self-gift. He recently served as the spiritual advisor to the Synod on Synodality in Rome. Catholic historian Dr. Miles Pattenden puts Radcliffe's appointment into perspective.
There does seem to be very much a sense that this is a reward for his service. He's already very much towards the end of his time as a voting cardinal. He turns 80, I think, in just a matter of months' time now. So he probably won't be voting in the next conclave, but this is a very important honorific.
Another priest who's been appointed a cardinal, 51-year-old Monsignor George Jacob Kuvakot, originally from India, is better known as Pope Francis's travel agent because he organizes the Pope's trips around the world. This church expert suggests Kuvakot's diplomacy background may be an advantage for his new role and for his future, given global world events.
If you look at the number of people who have been appointed from that crop of Secretariat of State who have some diplomatic service done to the Holy See in their ecclesiastical career, will that have or will that not have an impact on the outcome of a future conclave?
Another notable name in this consistory is Bishop Mykola Bychok, a Ukrainian Greek Catholic prelate who, at age 44, will become the youngest member of the College of Cardinals. But it's not just his young age drawing attention. Some Vatican watchers have raised whether his appointment is an insult to His Beatitude Sviatoslav Shevchuk, the primate of the Ukrainian Greek Catholic Church, who at times has been critical of Pope Francis's response to Russia's invasion of Ukraine. Beechock's appointment may also be a signal to church leaders in Australia, where he resides.
It's also, to some extent, a rebuke to the Australian Catholic Church, because, again, there is no red hat once more for the Archbishop of Sydney, Anthony Fisher, who is a very well-known figure throughout the global church, especially in the Anglosphere.
21 new red hats, meaning Pope Francis will have appointed about 80% of the Catholic cardinals tasked to elect the next pope.
Joining us now to discuss this weekend's consistory and the significance of Pope Francis's selections, we are joined by Frank Rocca, senior Vatican analyst for EWTN News. Frank, thanks for being with us. First, is there anything you wanted to add about the cardinals elect that we highlighted?
Well, I think there are a few perhaps interesting facts about Cardinal Designate Kuvakad. It's not actually the first organizer of papal trips to become a cardinal. John Paul II made the organizer of papal trips Cardinal Tucci, but he made it went after the age of 80. So it was he was a retired cardinal, but he wasn't a cardinal elector like Cardinal Designate Kuvakad. As for Cardinal Beechock, Cardinal Designate Beechock, it's interesting to note that. Some people say that, in fact, it wasn't intended as a slight to Archbishop Shevchuk, the head of the Ukrainian Greek Catholic Church, but in fact was more, reflected more concern that had Pope made Cardinal Shevchuk, had made Archbishop Shevchuk, Major Archbishop Shevchuk a cardinal, it would have been really provocative to the Russians because, of course, Major Archbishop Shevchuk is a big, big, big booster of the Ukrainian war effort and the defense of Ukraine in this war. So that's another way of looking at it. And finally, about Archbishop Leo, I would note that although he's the only North American and the closest thing to someone from the United States, he actually does have a link with the United States. He studied and taught at the University of Dayton in Ohio. So that may give him a little bit of status as an honorary American.
Right. That's important context there. And Frank, a number of the cardinals-elect made themselves available for interviews on Friday. You had the chance to speak with one of them, Father Timothy Radcliffe, and you asked him about his outreach to Catholics who identify as LGBT while adhering to church teaching on sexuality. Let's take a listen.
I really came in contact with that community through my work with people suffering from AIDS. That's when I got to see how much love and compassion there was in that LGBT community. In all my years of working, it's very rare people raise the issue of chastity. I think most of them know that I stand by the teaching of the church. So they don't come to me to find easy ways out. What they want in the first place is friendship, welcome, and recognition that they are, like all of us, fellow disciples seeking to follow the will of the Lord.
Frank, what did you take away from that exchange?
Well, I think it's interesting that the Father Radcliffe wants to stress that he does uphold Catholic teaching on sexuality, which is a controversial position in some quarters. He said it's holy and humane, but he wants to stress welcome. He wants to stress outreach. But it's interesting because he's often seen, perhaps from a distance, as being less faithful, let's say, or less traditional on this matter. He, for example, expressed some doubts about the reasons that the African bishops, for example, rejected fiducia supplicans, which gives permission for blessings of same-sex couples. And so he's saying, no, he wants to welcome, but he wants this teaching, is he said, it's holy and it's humane. The teaching on sexuality, and he said we don't need a new teaching on sexuality, even a pastoral theology of sexuality. So I thought that was interesting. Mm-hmm.
Frank, canon lawyer Dr. Kurt Martens made the point to me that St. John Paul II would more frequently convene all the cardinals together in Rome, while Pope Francis has limited those meetings. Here's what he told me.
The advantage of that was that all the cardinals were brought together outside a conclave, outside a pre-conclave, and got to know each other. Pope Francis has actually held
only one such consistory at the very beginning of his pontificate. But the cardinals have never seen each other as a group together.
Now, obviously, Frank, we cannot predict when the next conclave is going to be, but what kind of impact does it have that there have been so few opportunities for these cardinals to meet in person?
Yeah, it's true. I mean, Pope Francis did have a couple of extraordinary consistories right before consistories early in his pontificate. That gave the opportunity for cardinals to meet and to even stand up and raise issues in private. And we know that there was some pushback from some of the cardinals about the Pope's openness toward communion for the divorced and remarried early in that period. And so it may be that this reflects a kind of reluctance on the part of Pope Francis to have a sort of free-for-all for everybody to sort of stand up and sort of say his piece in front of other cardinals. And so maybe he would like more control of the situation. That's one way to read it. In any case, it's true that the most important single task and duty of a cardinal is to vote for the next pope in a conclave. But the cardinals are traditionally seen as the popes. They were called the Pope's Senate. They're supposed to be a body of advisors. Now, it's true that Pope Francis has drawn on many cardinals as advisors, and he established this Council of Cardinals, which meets every couple months and helps him in governance of the global church and the reform of the Vatican. But he doesn't seem to want the cardinals as a whole to play this role that way, in that traditional way. The impact on the conclave is to make it more unpredictable, because a lot of the ones that work in Rome all know each other very well, of course, and there are a few figures, especially Cardinal Parolin, the Cardinal Secretary of State, who travels all over the world, and he's known by all the cardinals. But otherwise, a lot of these men don't know each other at all. And what they know, they get from the press, with all the shortcomings that implies. And so when they come here, a lot of these people will really be looking around, wondering, presumably, where to go. And that will probably make certain figures very important as influencers, but that's all very speculative. But it certainly makes things less predictable.
Frank, we have just about under a minute left, but can you speak to what has Pope Francis's thumbprint been on the College of Cardinals, and how does it compare to that of his predecessors?
Well, we know that he's continued the process of making it more global. Increasing the presence in this time. He hasn't had so many Africans, but he has increased in the global South and certainly in Latin America and in Asia, and also from places that were unlikely places, like Laos or Papua New Guinea, to make cardinals from those places. So that was already a trend, of course, but he's really boosted that trend. But what his own imprint is frequently, for example, the Archbishop of Milan is not a cardinal. That traditionally was always the case. The Archbishop of Los Angeles, the largest diocese in the United States, we know he's not a cardinal. And yet he'll make cardinals in places that are not traditional red hat sees. And that's another that's another element of unpredictability. So that makes life interesting. It does raise a question of exactly what the cardinal's role is, because the men he chooses to be the pastors of the biggest local churches are not necessarily the people he wants to serve choosing the next pope. It disrupts things, like many other actions that Pope Francis has taken.
Absolutely. Definitely always interesting. And Frank, as always, grateful for your expertise. Thank you.
Thank you, Catherine.
The iconic Notre Dame Cathedral in Paris is set to reopen to the public this weekend on the Solemnity of the Immaculate Conception. French President Emmanuel Macron and journalists received a sneak peek of the Grand Church ahead of the official opening. 5 years after a devastating fire, the cathedral looks much like it did before, though visitors might notice a lighter interior thanks to the removal of centuries of dust and grime from the walls. EWTN News in Depth correspondent Colin Flynn will be at the cathedral's reopening events and will give us a closer look at Notre Dame's newly restored glory on this program next week. News headlines are next in the Week in Review. A stunning development in the long-running civil war in Syria tops the Week in Review. In a major blow to the government of President Bashar al-Assad, Islamic rebels launched a surprise offensive and captured the city of Aleppo and advanced on several other cities. It was the biggest battlefield challenge to the Assad regime since the civil war began 13 years ago, exposing the weakness of Syria's military. Thousands of terrified Syrians are now fleeing their homes as rebels close in on a march south towards the capital of Damascus. Following the fall of Aleppo, the Syrian Air Force and Russian warplanes launched airstrikes in areas outside the city in an attempt to stall the rebels' momentum. Aleppo is Syria's largest city and an ancient hub of Middle East culture and commerce. The historic center of Eastern Christianity, it is home to a wide mixture of denominations, including Armenian Catholics, Greek Orthodox, Maronites, and Chaldeans. There is worry about how those communities will fare under rebel rule.
The number of Christians in Aleppo is much smaller than it was before the war, but there's still tens of thousands, maybe 20, maybe 30,000 Christians in Aleppo. They're under Islamist rule now. They don't know what to expect. Obviously, things could be better than they fear, or they could be worse than they hoped. We're in very early days. The rebels have said all the right things so far, but it's very early.
The long civil war in Syria has killed an estimated 500,000 people and fractured the country. Only intervention by Russia, Iran, and Iranian-backed Hezbollah has allowed Assad to remain in power, with 70% of Syria under his control until the offensive this week. It's been just 1 week since Israel and the militant group Hezbollah agreed to a ceasefire, but tensions remain high as daily strikes in southern Lebanon strain the fragile truce. Since the ceasefire went into effect last Wednesday, both sides have claimed the other violated it. Israel conducted airstrikes in southern Lebanon in retaliation for Hezbollah firing rockets into Israel-occupied territory. Though the strikes continue, military analysts say it's far less intense and not a sign that the truce will collapse. But Israel's defense minister threatened to directly target the Lebanese state should Hezbollah violate the ceasefire. At his Angelus last Sunday, Pope Francis praised the ceasefire and expressed his hope it could lead to pauses in fighting on other fronts. Chaos erupted in South Korea this week after a sudden decree of martial law put the nation in political turmoil. Though the order was short-lived, the president now faces widespread calls to resign and threats of impeachment, including from his own party. Shortly after President Yoon Suk-yeol declared martial law late Tuesday night, protesters clashed with authorities as parliament members pushed past armed troops to enter the National Assembly building and call off the decree. Yoon says he called martial law to resolve a political deadlock and eliminate what he called anti-state forces in the opposition party. Though martial law lasted only a few hours, it sparked backlash from across the globe, including in the United States, a key ally, with thousands of American troops stationed in the East Asian nation. More than a week of violent protests in the Eastern European nation of Georgia after its government suspended negotiations on joining the European Union. Many Georgians saw a seat at the EU as an opportunity to join the West and the government's decision as a pivot toward Russia. Demonstrators have thrown fireworks and built barricades in the capital city of Tbilisi, and police have responded with water cannons and tear gas. More than 300 protesters have been detained and dozens treated for injuries. The pro-Russia ruling party halted talks for accession after the European Union called its highly contested election win in October as, quote, neither free nor fair. The Biden administration is attempting to rush additional military aid to Ukraine before the handoff to a new presidency and what might be an abrupt shift in U.S. policy. The State Department announced on Monday the U.S. will send an additional $725 million in military aid to Kyiv, including munitions to counter drones, ammunition for the HIMARS rocket system, and anti-personnel landmines. National Security Advisor Jake Sullivan said before the Trump inauguration in January, the administration will also send thousands of artillery rounds and rockets, seeking to put Ukraine in the strongest possible position before potential future talks with Russia to end the conflict. Right now, senior administration officials say the biggest concern for Ukraine may not be the amount of military aid it is receiving, but rather manpower shortages to field an army and rotate exhausted troops off of the front lines. President Joe Biden has made his last foreign trip to meet with the head of state and his first trip as president to the African continent. Mr. Biden visited Angola to promote Washington's investments in the country and to acknowledge America's link to Angola, which is where the first African slaves were trafficked. The president was welcomed by his Angolan counterpart on Tuesday in the Angolan capital of Luanda. The centerpiece of the visit, a U.S. commitment to an 800-mile transcontinental railway project linking Zambia, Congo, and Angola, meant to make it easier to move critical raw materials needed for technology manufacturing from interior countries to Western ports. It is America's largest ever overseas rail investment. The enhanced transportation corridor is seen as a counter to China's deepening influence in Africa. China has spent hundreds of billions of dollars in infrastructure, mining, and processing of African minerals and has signed a deal to revamp a separate railway line in another part of the continent. The corridor won't be finished for years, meaning much of it would be constructed during the Trump administration. The Biden White House is encouraging its completion as a smart way to compete with Chinese influence, not only politically, but also from a business perspective.
All these projects and investments are designed to have high impact and meet the highest standards for workers, for the environment, and for the communities. Because the United States understands how we invest in Africa is just as important as how much we invest in Africa.
Biden also toured Angola's National Slavery Museum. The first African slaves to come to the U.S. in the early 1600s arrived from these very shores. Angola was the departure point for an estimated 6 million enslaved people. Back at home, days later, the president then presided for the last time at the annual lighting of the national Christmas tree Thursday evening on the White House ellipse. Biden wished the crowd a Merry Christmas and said his parting hope for the nation was to continue to seek the light of liberty and love, kindness and compassion and dignity and decency. Next, a faith-filled trip to America's heartland.
Welcome to McCool Junction, a small community here in Nebraska where faith and farming come together to feed America. We've got that story coming up.
Reporter Mark Irons introduces us to a Catholic family keeping farm life alive in the Midwest. It's hard to feed the hungry without the hard work of farmers. For more than 100 years, the Clark family in Nebraska has farmed by planting trust in divine providence. They are among a small group of Catholic family farmers keeping a traditional way of life alive in America's heartland. Mark Irons takes us to the Cornhusker State to meet the Clark family in this Catholic Life report.
Nebraska farmland seems to have no boundary, stretching out to the horizon and beyond. What's produced here has a similar reach. The corn, beef, or pork might end up in your local grocery store, restaurants in every corner of America, or on a dinner plate in another country.
You know, they say farmers feed the world.
Do you think the average American takes farming for granted?
No, I don't think.
I don't think they understand.
We learned it's no petting zoo and asked, what does it take to feed the world?
I mean, how hard is it? The life of a hog farmer. It's 365 days a year. We're here at Christmas, we're here at 4th of July, we're here on weekends.
Everything is really expensive anymore. Combines, tractors, cost your seed. So it takes a lot of effort to produce a crop.
How would you describe farming? Is it stable work, or is there some nights you go to bed and you wonder, what's tomorrow going to bring?
When the weather's beautiful, everything's fine. And then when the snowstorm hits or severe rain, it's, you know.
Drought,
and then it really, you know, wants to stress you out.
At times, it can be a burden, but for Alan and Shelley Clark, farming is in their blood, running back more than a century.
November 18,
1909. 1909.
Yeah.
The family farm history is in this book.
Yeah, and they kept track of every penny they spent. And this is corn.
Line after line documents farming from the Clark family past. Row after row, today, Alan's brother, Ron, continues the fall harvest of corn.
And that's showing what it's yielding.
Records are no longer kept by pen and a notebook. Advanced computerized technology has provided a benefit to farmers that generations past couldn't have dreamed of. One thing has stayed the same, the Catholic faith of these farmers.
Thankful for my parents, you know, that gave us the faith, you know, yeah. And thankful I can pass it on.
Can you farm without faith?
I don't think so.
Oh, I don't suppose so.
Alan's nephew, Matthew Clark, a hog farmer, put it this way.
I think to be a farmer, you have to have true faith because we rely on God to, we need good weather, good crops. We need healthy animals. All that is, I mean, you have to have true faith.
So through this holy sacrifice of the Mass, we give thanks to God for a safe and fruitful harvest, and ask him to bless and protect us always.
Around 500 people live in the tiny farming community of McCool Junction in Nebraska. A short walk from the post office, St. Patrick's Church stands on a quiet street. Inside this snug Catholic church, neighbors and familial faces gather in thanks.
Give us this day our daily bread. And forgive us our trespasses.
Along with Ron, Alan and Shelley Clark are joined by their children and grandchildren in the pews.
Have mercy.
And one of their sons, Eric, presides as the priest.
And the greatest prayer is to give thanks to God in the form of the Eucharist.
Does the Eucharist recall for us the idea of harvest and the fruits of the earth and of being a gift?
Yeah, we see this even in the Jewish Old Testament, right? Like after the harvest, they would offer up a thanksgiving offering to God. Every Mass is an offering up to God for thanksgiving. But to see that, yeah, this wheat and these grapes were crushed in order to offer up a sacrifice, just as Jesus, our Lord, was crushed for our sins to offer up a sacrifice to God.
Worship, prayer, and thanksgiving are offered around the altar.
Bless us, O Lord, in these thy gifts.
And faith and family bonds are strengthened around the dinner table.
What value do you think does that have, coming together as a family and eating together?
I think it has a lot to do with it. You know, his mother started that years ago, feeding everybody, the hired men and everybody, all at noon. And
I think it's, I don't know, it's the time you listen to the kids.
Yep.
You know, what happened to their lives, where normally, you know, they're running here and there.
An additional kids' table is evidence of the Clark family growth.
So, yeah.
Alan and Shelley have five children and a crop of grandchildren who share what it's like to be raised in a farm family.
I'm used to being able to go outside. Mom doesn't have to wash me quite as much because we live in, like, a little area.
For those who married into the family, leaving city life behind brought a greater awareness of the labor it takes to farm and ultimately provide the meals we all enjoy.
It was quite a shock from living in D.C.
A meal offers time to catch up or tell stories that they can laugh about now. But Father Eric's brother, Alex, reminds us farming comes with risks as he reflects on the time he was electrocuted caring for the cattle.
I had a sick heifer I was bringing down the chute. It just rained that morning and there was water.
I mean, that shows you the dangers of farming. It's real.
Yeah,
but it doesn't keep you down.
No.
And there's something satisfying about tasting world-class Nebraska beef, knowing it came to the table fresh from the farm. Alex works at the cattle feedlot with his brother Andrew.
Cattle don't take a day off, so we still had to try to make it out here, and regardless, rain, snow, or shine, you got to be here.
A concrete slab imprinted with the family name, dated 1920, marks the legacy that began here more than 100 years ago and has survived hard times, including financial crisis in the 80s, when many Midwest farms faced foreclosures.
We felt, very blessed. In the farm crisis in the 80s, you know, not a lot of people were so fortunate like us.
Alex and Andrew work with their father, caring for and feeding the cattle before they're shipped off to slaughter and packing houses. The Clarks face the added challenge of operating in a beef industry that is run predominantly by major corporations. Having a small family-owned operation in a field packed with corporate competitors carves out even more reason to count on God.
Daily prayer, going to Mass, you know, weekly, it just having God as your rock and your foundation to help overcome those challenges plays a big role.
Hundreds of harvests have come and gone for generations of Clark family farmers. The farm could stay in the family hundreds of years from now, but that's not the most important thing.
I see your grandkids running around. What do you hope to pass on to them?
Just be respectful to everybody.
Be Catholic.
Yeah. Feeding the world is quite the challenge, but faith can reach beyond the horizon. Mark Irons, EWTN News in Depth.
Farming is not just a generational tradition for the Clark family and so many other longtime farmers. New data from the U.S. Department of Agriculture shows there's an increase in the number of beginner farmers, those with 10 years of experience or less.
Next, a renewed conversation about bringing back an old Catholic tradition, Meatless Fridays. A discussion about abstaining from meat and fasting with the founder of the Institute of Catholic Culture when we come back.
Welcome back. A leading U.S. Catholic bishop is calling for a return to Meatless Fridays. Archbishop Boris Gudziak chairs the U.S. Bishops Committee on Domestic Justice and Human Development. He addressed his brother bishops at their fall meeting last month with this proposal.
We could renew the tradition of Friday abstinence from meat. A return to Friday abstinence would be good for the soul and for the planet. Maybe for something else. Uniting our devotion to the Lord and reverence for the Lord's creation.
On top of the spiritual benefits, Gudziak said reviving this tradition is a way to commemorate the upcoming 10th anniversary of Pope Francis's encyclical on the environment, Laudato Si, and would be a way to be synodal and engage with ancient practices in the Latin Rite. Joining us now to discuss the church's long tradition of abstaining from meat and fasting on certain days and seasons, including Advent, is Father Hezekias Carnazzo, founder and executive director of the Institute of Catholic Culture. Father, thanks for joining us. Archbishop Gudziak really stirred up this conversation topic recently about Catholics returning to this tradition of abstaining from meat on Fridays beyond the season of Lent. What's your reaction when you heard that suggestion?
Well, the bishop's absolutely right, and it's a calling to restore the apostolic practice. It was the Didache, the one of the earliest catechisms of the church, written, it's believed to be written in the mid to later part of the first century, while the apostles are still alive, before some of the New Testament was even written, calling Christians to fast on Wednesdays and Fridays. Wednesday because it's the day that Judas turned in our Lord, and of course Friday because of the cross. And so the Archbishop is simply calling for a restoration of that apostolic practice.
Mm-hmm. And just following up on that, Father, can you clarify what does the Church require of the faithful on Fridays when it comes to fasting? What's their tradition, and are we required to do some kind of penance on Fridays?
Absolutely, the Church does require us to fast on Fridays throughout the year, or to abstain on Fridays throughout the year at least, or to do some other form of penance. But, you know, the Lord himself said in the Gospel of Luke, the days will come when the bridegroom is taken away from them. Then they, that is his followers, will fast. So it's a mark of the Christians that we fast, and we should seek to restore that in our lives.
And just another follow-up to that again, just so some members of our audience don't need to suffer from unnecessary Catholic guilt, there are exceptions to this call to fast, aren't there?
Yeah, absolutely. Due to age or illness or whatever, or pregnancy, whatever the case may be, you know, we oftentimes approach the fasting of the church in terms of obligation, but I think it's much more profitable to approach it in terms of invitation. Mm-hmm. Not so much as what we have to do, but what we can do to restore our communion with God.
That's beautiful. And we are entering now into the season of Advent, which is a little Lent. So what are the church's guidelines, expectations with fasting during this particular liturgical season, and why?
Sure. Advent was traditionally a time of fasting. Historically, traditionally, the fast of the church in the East and West was a 40-day preparation. It was an Advent Lent, if you will, starting in the West on the day following St. Martin of Tours feast day on November 11th, 40 days of preparation. Regardless of when that starts, Nevertheless, Advent is a time of penance, of preparation, to get our hearts ready for the coming of Christ in the flesh. And as I oftentimes share, you know, at the Institute of Catholic Culture, we have to decide what we want to have happen in our lives on Christmas Day. Do we want, you know, Santa to come sliding down the chimney, or Christ to be born in our hearts? Mm-hmm. And if we want the Lord to be born, to have a communion with him, we have to prepare for that day.
That's a great reminder of what these days are all about. Can you put some more scriptural perspective on this practice of fasting, Father? God has called us to this practice really from the start, hasn't he?
Well, it was in the Garden of Eden that the Lord placed the first fast on our parents, telling them not to eat of the tree of knowledge of good and evil. And of course, the devil caused that to be the point of the fall, right? And convincing our first parents that through eating of the tree, they would actually become like God. And so in that moment, they divorced themselves from their real source of life and sought life in the created order. Not that the created order is bad, but only in its communion with God. It receives its life from God. And we seek to use creation and use food as an end in itself, then we will receive that which is hidden there, and that is death. And notice that it's our Lord who begins his ministry by fasting, right? Mm. And then therefore restoring our relationship with food and our communion with God as a priority.
Mm, that's beautiful. Father, we have about a minute remaining, but can you just expand again on the benefits and beauty of fasting? Something to encourage us with.
Sure. Yeah. I have the beautiful words of St. Basil the Great. He says, fasting is a chariot to heaven. It gives rise to prophets and brings wisdom to lawgivers. It is good protection for the soul and a sure companion for the body. It has quenched the power of fire and stopped the mouths of lions. Fasting lifts our prayer to heaven. It is, as I said before, it is the mark of the Christians that we fast. And I encourage all of your viewers today to take that apostolic practice seriously as a vehicle by which we can come more profitably to the day of the nativity of our Lord and Savior Jesus Christ.
What a great reminder, especially as we lean more deeply into this Advent season. Father, thank you so much.
Blessing to be with you.
The penitential season of Advent is a great time to not only offer up extra fasts, but to take on more prayers and devotions. Like Father Hezekiah mentioned, these sacrifices, whether big or small, can help to prepare our hearts for Christmas and the second coming of Christ. Our sister publication, the Catholic News Agency, is sharing Catholic apps, reflections, and devotionals to help you grow in your faith this Advent. You can find these resources and more at CatholicNewsAgency.com. And that does it for this edition of EWTN News in Depth. I'm Catherine Hadro. We hope to see you again same time next week for more news important to your Catholic life, including our big report from correspondent Colin Flynn on the grand reopening of the Notre Dame Cathedral in Paris. Until then, God bless.